Welcome to Youth Culture Matters, a podcast from the Center for Parent Youth Understanding. We've taken a short break from recording new episodes, so today we want to go back into our archives to highlight a timely conversation. Today's episode is a look back at a discussion with Peter Linus that aims to help us better understand the transgender issues rapidly taking shape in today's culture. Listen into a replay of episode 83, titled Understanding Transgender in a Changing Culture with Peter Linus. This episode was originally released on May 13th, 2019.
It wasn't until the late 1960s and early 1970s that the term transgender was first coined and used. In today's world, the word sits front and center on our collective cultural consciousness as more and more people are referring to themselves as transgender and as transgender activism intensifies. The reality is, more and more gender dysphoric kids are showing up in our youth groups. For those of us doing ministry in the church, we should be thinking about how to minister with grace, truth, and compassion to those who identify as transgender. Peter Linus is approaching the issue in this way as he helps the Christian community in the UK think through the theological, pastoral, and legal implications of ministry to the transgendered. Stay with us as Peter guides us through the difficult issues related to what it means to love and care for the transgendered on this episode of Youth Culture Matters.
From the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, this is Youth Culture Matters. If you're a parent, youth worker, educator, counselor, grandparent, or anyone else who cares about kids, we're glad you've joined us for this practical, informative, and hope-filled podcast. This is a place where together we talk and think Christianly about the rapidly changing world of today's children, teens, and young adults.
Well, welcome everybody to another episode of Youth Culture Matters. I'm Walt Mueller, and today I am filled with joy as my good buddy Duffy Robbins is joining me as our co-host today. Duffy's the professor, a professor of student ministries at Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania, and then Duffy and I do a lot of work together here through CPYU and in the youth ministry world. We're going to have a conversation with Peter Linus. Before we get to him and we tell you a little bit about him and why he's on here with us today, we are going to talk about the transgender issue. And Duffy, this is something that we address in a couple of places together more formally at Gordon-Conwell Seminary, where we do some work together. I don't know if you want to mention very quickly something about the symposium that we have coming up.
Yeah, I'd love to, and thanks for letting me join you today, Walt. Always a pleasure, my friend. This symposium at Gordon-Conwell, this is something that we sort of dreamed about a few years ago. We said, that so often when we have discussions about ministry to transgender students, which is such an important, such a timely topic, that it seemed like we spent a lot of time litigating theological questions, which are important theological questions, but those absolutely essential preliminary questions usually prevented us from talking about the practical questions. Even if you agree that you really want to respect and honor and adhere to traditional biblical orthodox standards of sexuality, there are a myriad of questions that remain, practical questions, hard questions, and questions that should be sort of worked out in the context of community. And so we try to imagine creating that sort of context for a few days where youth workers can come together. And as you know, we've done this now for the last 2 years at Gordon-Conwell. We do it in January. It's just been fantastic. The people that come, the conversations, the questions, we do some common readings together. We've interviewed some amazing people. I'm hoping we'll be able to get Peter yes. Linus to join us next January by Skype or something. I think to a person, everyone has found it very, very helpful. It's just a thoughtful group of people engaged in really, really critical and compassionate debate. So I've enjoyed it immensely.
Yeah, I feel like I learned as much or more than the people who were there, and it's just a wonderful interchange. If anybody's interested in that symposium on traditional biblical sexuality and a changing youth culture, that will be January 6th through 9th of 2020, and we'll include a link on our cpyu.org page for this particular podcast under the player, or you could just go and visit the Gordon Conwell website, search that, and you could get registered. It's limited in terms of the number of people who were there. Well, I want to introduce Peter Linus. I'm so thrilled that Peter has joined us. Peter, are you in Belfast right now?
I'm actually in a little place called Port Stewart on the very north coast of Northern Ireland, near the Giant's Causeway.
I've been to Port Stewart.
I knew this was going to happen.
That's awesome.
Duffy, Peter, if you need any help at all, locating anything in Northern Ireland, and especially restaurants, talk to Duffy. He is your tour guide. So I know you're from there, but he knows more than you know. I'll just guarantee that.
I don't, but he loves it.
Yeah. Yeah, so Peter is the director of the Evangelical Alliance in Northern Ireland, and that's, he can tell us more about that. That's a UK-wide organization there. He has an MDiv at Regent College in Vancouver, and you're actually on the board there, huh? At Regent.
I am indeed. So I get three trips a year out to Vancouver. We loved being there and get to go back from time to time. So it was hugely influential on my thinking, and I love getting to engage in that wider context. So under some understanding of North America and some of the thinking going on there.
Well, when you get us figured out, let us know, because we need some help with that. I got to tell you, some of my heroes of the faith and friends, you know, J.I. Packer up there. Yes. And then I don't know if you know Steve Garber. Steve's a good buddy and just love Steve and what he's doing. So he's up there. You've also taught at Westminster Theological Center and Belfast Bible College. And you're married. You have two daughters. I see here. You love running and you hate fish. That's awesome. I don't know that I've ever met someone that's put that in their bio. Now, just to let people know, the way that I found out about Peter was that a few months ago, Duffy actually told me about one of his favorite podcasts, which is called Unbelievable out of the UK. Justin Brierley hosts that, and it is phenomenal. If anybody has not heard of that, you need to check that out. I think that's a weekly podcast where there's lots of give and take and debate. And back in March, Peter was a guest on the podcast with Justin, and he was working to discuss and answer the question, how should the church respond to transgender? And you engaged in a dialogue. Obviously, it wasn't the first dialogue you've had with Jenny Ann Bishop, but you engaged in dialogue with Jenny Ann Bishop. That was really an insightful conversation. Jenny Ann is a transgender activist and has transitioned, I think, born biological male, transitioned to female. And yeah, it was a spirited conversation and very eye-opening. And as I listened to the podcast, Peter talked a lot about this pastoral paper he's written called Transformed, put out by the Evangelical Alliance. So that's what we want to talk about today, some very practical helps. You know, why did you write this? Why did you write the paper Transformed?
Well, a couple of reasons. One is Evangelical Alliance has been around for about 170 years, and we serve the church. We are interested in uniting the church around mission and advocacy. And we put it like this. We love Jesus and want people to meet him. We love the church and want to help it to thrive. And we love the public square and want to help Christians in that space. When it came to the transgender resource, the short answer is nobody else wanted to write it. I have a background in law. I worked as a lawyer and a barrister, court barrister for 5 years, then studied theology. I love the public square and how our faith engages in that space. And this was an issue that we were getting asked questions about. And so I was digging around, doing research to respond. And I kept saying, we need to do a resource. And everybody kept saying, well, you're the one who thinks we need to do it. So why don't you go and write it? So really, it was in response to questions from the church and a deep reluctance of many other people really to do it. And I wanted something that was practical, that was accessible. There's been some good stuff written, not a lot. But what I really wanted was something a parent could sit down with in an evening or a youth leader read and hopefully get a basic introduction to this topic, which is always moving and is vast and can feel overwhelming.
Yeah, and I think
you know, what's really important for people to know is, as I read this, it was apparent that there were at least two avenues you went down. I know there were more than that. One was the theology, you know, what is the theology that should inform our response to this? But you also spent a lot of time talking to folks who have dealt with this firsthand in their own lives or with family members. Yeah, talk a little bit about that, because you came away with, there was a statement you made in the Unbelievable podcast, and it's actually a little call-out box now in Transformed, the PDF that folks can download. It says, if you have met one transgender person, you have met one transgender person. No two experiences are the same.
Yeah, that was one of the most striking things. So I decided to meet the transgender groups within Northern Ireland. We're relatively small. There are three or four main groups. And I asked them all, would they meet? I already worked within the LGBT community at times, so I knew some people in that space. They knew that we knew how to respectfully disagree. And so I had some relationships there. And so we invited people in, and that was during one of the meetings. Somebody said that line to me, and it really struck out to me, because in a way I was looking for maybe a simple answer or a formula. And it was a really healthy reminder that actually so many people experience this in different ways. And helpful for us, I think, as a church. And actually, as I listened to the different transgender groups, they all had different perspectives as to how this came about, why it comes about, how we might respond. And I was trying to say to them, do you understand why it might be difficult for us then as churches and as youth groups and parents to know how even to respond? Because there's not agreement within the transgender community on causes, on treatments, on responses to it. But I think that's helpful for us as Christians and anybody to say, look, people come to this, arrive at this for different reasons, different medical diagnoses. They respond to it in different ways as family. There is no one simple response to the transgender issue or transgender people. And again, that's another thing I want to separate out sometimes. There's an ideology behind some of this and some thinking we need to wrestle with. But then there are people who are coming in deep pain who are often not particularly engaged in the ideology at all. And we need to be careful how we respond to each of those.
Mm. What were some of the specific, I mean, were you able to categorize, you know, did there seem to be lumps kind of reasons that you were able to categorize as you, you know, worked to sort out these differences as you engaged with conversations with folks?
Well, certainly one of the interesting trends that we might pick up again is if you'd said to me 5 years ago somebody was going to a transgender clinic, I'd have said statistically they were very likely to be male. They were very likely to be much, as in born male, much younger, you know, average age, maybe 5, 6, 7. And they were very likely to stay in their birth gender over time. Now, if you said to me that somebody was at a transgender clinic, certainly in the UK yesterday, for example, I would say then now statistically, they're likely to be 14, 15. They're likely to be born female, and they're much more likely to push through with transition because parents are excluded. They can go straight onto blockers and a range of other factors. So, but that's a huge shift in would have been a younger male, unlikely to transition, now more likely to be an older, like teenage female and likely to transition. That straight away, we need to get more data and understanding of, and there's actually a reluctance even to do research. So that's just one simple big trend that's occurred recently that we don't really understand. Nobody does. And that's really worrying. In terms of the primary lens we have on this was to be compassionate. We want to see people loved and treated well. But if you don't have even information on that medically, scientifically, then we're not going to respond well, let alone how we want to come biblically, pastorally, and theologically at this. So we're not alone in having questions. Our whole society is confused by this issue and lacks clarity. And one of the things we want to say as Christians is we're not alone in not fully understanding some of this. But we do have some lenses by which we want to begin to respond to it. And that's important to try and get, I think, those things across.
Hmm. Let me ask a question, Peter. You in the Evangelical Alliance, had you guys been contacted? What kind of questions were you getting from churches? You said, you know, the people ask, what were the top five questions that you were being asked? I mean, obviously, I'm guessing one of them is the question Walt articulated, and just literally, should I use this person's preferred name? But I'm sure there were other bigger ones, or were they just practical questions like that?
Yeah, so exactly that. Names was definitely one of them. Baptism came up for a couple of groups we were talking to. So You know, how do you wrestle with that? So particularly somebody who's coming to faith, but maybe very early in that journey and still processing their identity around gender. Very practical questions around toilets or accommodation. And a number of concerns. So if you've got older teenagers, they tend to know each other, trans teenagers, this rapid onset gender dysphoria, they'll tend to be in online forums and talking to each other. So if you provide a welcome for one, and that's a great thing, then often others will come because they don't have that many spaces in which they feel welcomed. But churches were a little concerned sometimes about a tipping point where suddenly you go in a small youth group from one to four or five transgender people, and they're going, we're really excited that we're able to welcome them in, but we're really concerned as to how we articulate well what we believe. At what point do we begin to make that clear? And they're really discipleship questions and good questions and very difficult to give a sort of definitive answer. Depends on the age of the person, what background they're coming from, where's their family. They all want to disciple people into a good response, but they want to get the timing of that right so as not to immediately alienate somebody, but also not to say you're welcome and you just stay without changing at all. There has to be a response and come under the gospel.
You know, those questions are the sorts of questions that definitely come up at our symposium. Another question, and I guess this is sort of related to the question of toilets, but we've had people at our symposium who are also involved in camping ministry. And so, and this is in some of the material that's been written here in the States about this. One of the big practical questions youth workers have is when we have a camp, does a trans student go in the girls' cabin, or do they go into the guys' cabin? And we had one guy, for example, who was a national leader in his denomination, and said that if we put, we were afraid if we put the, you know, the guy trans guy in the girls' cabin, that was going to be a problem. But if we put the guy who's trans, transitioning into a female into a guy's cabin, then we were afraid he might get bullied. And I hope we can maybe talk about that question. But that's another big question. We don't have to answer it this minute, but that's another big question that that came up, is how do we accommodate and how do we show hospitality to our friends who are transgender without making other kids in the same space feel uncomfortable. And that was a big question that came up.
Yeah, let's. We're going to come back to that. We do want to get very practical, and that is a big issue. I'm sure you've had to deal with that or heard that in Ireland with camping as well, Peter. We're going to come back and talk about that. We need to take a break. We're talking to Peter Linus. He's authored a pastoral paper called Transformed. We will have a link to that. We highly suggest that you download that you read it, that you discuss it with folks that you're ministering with. Just go to our page, cpyu.org, look for this podcast in the player, and then you'll be able to download that and see that. Stick with us. We'll be right back. In an effort to help you help the kids you know and love navigate their emerging sexuality to the glory of God, we've launched a sexual integrity initiative here at CPYU. Thanks to a generous grant from a company called DAS, you can access our Sexual Integrity Initiative and a growing number of resources for free by visiting the website at sexualintegrityinitiative.com. Welcome back to Youth Culture Matters. We're having a chat with Peter Linus. Duffy asked a question right before the break, Peter, about camping, a specific, very practical question that we know youth workers and parents and camp directors have to deal with increasingly. Any response you have to that?
So there's always a kind of legal framework everybody needs to be aware of. And certainly within the UK, I'm more aware. I'm not going to comment on the American legal framework, but certainly an under 18 in our context can't reassign their gender. They can't go through a legal process. So in the UK, you're safe to keep people in single sex as long as you're consistent. But the more practical, so you need to know that for your own context, anybody listening, but the more practical is probably even engaging with the person. Most people under 18 either haven't transitioned or certainly haven't fully transitioned, or often not that comfortable in either space. So often finding a single sex, a single room or is going to be a solution, or a single tent scenario, or something a little different, because they're not often that comfortable being in a an environment with those of either the sex they're wanting to move to or not. So it's not that we're going to condone or condemn. That's often seen as the two choices. We're sometimes trying to find a third way in this space where you have somebody new coming in. We want to provide that welcome, and actually they often don't want to be in the different environment. Now, that's not always going to be the case, and sometimes we'll have to say, well, actually, we don't feel comfortable with you in either environment. We are prepared to make a provision for you. Here's what it looks like. There's a unisex or disabled toilet or shower, something you can use that keeps you separate and protects you in that moment, because rights have responsibilities, and that's the tension point for all of us in this moment. So we're trying to find creative solutions that don't alienate the person, but also don't put others potentially either at risk or just feeling awkward. And we've got to recognize both groups in this moment, or all groups. And it is difficult in each situation. There's no doubt about it.
Well, I was just going to say that it was more, I think that part of the discussion was the person hadn't necessarily biologically begun to transition, but they were more just cosmetically or in clothing. And so, like the one guy that was sort of the national director for his nomination, and he was talking about a guy that was beginning to sort of dress like a girl, and they were afraid that if they put him in the guy's cabin that he was going to be bullied. But it was precisely because he was still a male that they didn't want to put him in the female cabin. That definitely came up, the idea of, okay, a third, like you said, a unisex cabin or a third cabin. But even there was the question of, well, obviously you don't want that kid to be by themselves. So you put one counselor in there. That's that in the States, that's typically seen as probably not a very good idea. And if you say, oh, okay, so we're going to put a second counselor in there. Well, now it's sounding like a lot of fun. For the kid, I get to spend a week with two adults. And so that was it left us uncomfortable, where we didn't feel good about any of the, not that you have to solve this, but I guess that was a thorny problem that a lot of the youth workers were facing, because most of them are dealing with people who are under 18, but it was other transitioning behaviors that they are responding to, not just biological or surgical transition.
Yeah,
and I think these are absolutely tough questions. Again, one of the groups I met said to me, look, sometimes you need to see this a little bit through a lens of disability. And I was kind of slightly surprised by that. And I said, if I said that, you'd probably resist. And they said, yes, but hold on, listen a little further. So a school or a camp always has to accommodate somebody who's disabled, but that doesn't mean there's a simple policy that just says you do X, because somebody who's blind will need a different sort of solution than somebody who's in a wheelchair. We'll need a different solution than somebody who's maybe on the autistic spectrum. And it was helpful again to get me think, okay, so we need to think a little differently in each situation. That doesn't, again, immediately give us the answer. There isn't always going to be a simple answer. Sometimes we're going to have a tough conversation with a parent or with a child and say, actually, this is a really small camp. We don't have that option. Or here's the best solution we can come up with at this moment, is a tent beside the others. There'll be a supervising adult nearby, but they can't be in with them. And we'll have to talk through a range of options. But we may have to treat, as I say, each one slightly differently, because different people are in a different stage of the journey, without saying we're accepting everything that's going on here, but we still want to minister to you, and we know you're on a journey. And it's trying to do a number of different communication pieces in one go, which can be really difficult, for sure.
Yeah.
I love your answer here, and I'm going to something you wrote in Transformed. This is actually the first sentence in your section on how can the church respond pastorally. You say, any response offered to someone wrestling with issues surrounding transgender and faith should be rooted theologically and oriented pastorally. And that's what I'm hearing you say here. And I think sometimes we get, we have an imbalance there. And I know in our youth ministry world here, you know, if we talk about truth and grace, we have some who err on the side of truth, or maybe it's better to say law, and then some who err on the side of grace. You know, all things are permissible. And, you know, how, as you've worked to navigate that, and you've had these conversations with folks in the transgender community, it sounds to me like the reception you've received is one that's very welcoming. You know, maybe not that I'm sure that not everybody agrees with you on everything, but just talk about the posture, because it this is what we need to learn from here. You've walked this journey. Does that make sense, what I'm asking?
I think so. So something I was probably hinting at earlier was relationships are really crucial. So yeah. We're very clear on our views around sexuality and have articulated that, done media around that. But at the same time, because of how that's been done and because of certain relationships, even built in radio studios with people I was on the opposite side to, I was invited into a Pride event to do a Q&A in which they knew I was going to articulate a view against same-sex marriage, and was able to do that in a way. So then the relationships were there. So some people came to our office and said, I might not have come, but we knew the work that you did elsewhere, and we knew you weren't going to be with us, but we were open to it. And the first thing we did was just invite everybody. And if they said no, that was fine. It turned out everybody said yes. So there's an opportunity for some of us maybe to reach out and say, well, let's go and meet the groups who are in this space, at least listen and hear the first round of concerns. I heard new things that I wouldn't have got if I just read the literature. And I opened up a space for some conversation, and some of those people have come back to me. They don't agree with everything in the document, inevitably, but I think they see the tone. But the other thing, again, that we're hinting at there is an ideological moment. So sometimes you'll meet an activist, and they are out to push an ideology. And behind a lot of this is queer theory and an ideology that we have serious problems with and concerns with. And there are moments we need to say, hold on, that's deeply problematic. Mm-hmm. You don't understand what it is to be made in the image of God. You don't understand what we're completely at odds with that. And then there is sometimes a 13-year-old kid or a parent who's got a young 6-year-old, and they're just broken because they don't know what's going on with that child, or the young person doesn't quite know what's going on. If we hit them ideologically and say, you've embraced queer theory, you're so far from God, this is so problematic, it just goes over there. They don't understand. They're like, I just don't feel at ease in my body. I don't know what else to tell you. So at that moment, we need to journey a little bit more pastorally and take them on the movement through. So that's a real bridging. I think we saw Jesus do that with the woman at the well, that initial compassion. He moves very quickly to say, hey, bring your husband. And she says, I don't have a husband. And he goes through the five husbands. I mean, he moves to a truth encounter in minutes. That might take us a few weeks, a few months, because we're not Jesus. He models something, but he does it at a speed that we probably can't replicate. But it's always redemptive, because she brings her friends to meet Jesus. And what I always want to see is somebody from the trans community knowing that they're welcome, not to stay as they are, but to come in. And ultimately, always hoping that we're moving towards that redemptive moment of encounter with Jesus, because that's what I had, not as a trans person, but as a broken person in my way. And I didn't stay where I was. And I want somebody else to come to meet Jesus and to move. But that's his work, and my job is to make the encounter moment happen.
I really appreciated that in your booklet. I really appreciated that reference to John 4. I thought that was a great insight and a really helpful kind of big picture paradigm of engagement, the way you kind of move from compassion to integrity. That seems like a really important piece to this whole thing in terms of pastoral response. Mm.
So practically for me, just to say, I suppose, is on the names. So I mean, I have real issues at one level with names, but actually I've just decided that's not the hill I want to die on. And if I don't use a trans person's name, when I invite people from the trans community to come and meet me, if I don't use the name that they're telling me, there's no conversation. I don't think I'm accepting all their agenda because of other things I'm going to say and make clear to them. I understand why for other people that's a great difficulty. I wouldn't like to be a teacher in this space at the minute. I understand why that can be. But for me, I looked at somebody like Daniel, and I'm not saying it's the perfect analogy, but I saw how he took the name Belteshazzar, a name clearly to foreign God, but he drew a line at a different point. And I suppose that helped me go, okay, I can use the name. I struggle a bit more with pronouns. I feel less comfortable with that. If I'm right in front of the person, I often don't know if they're trans. And if I want to keep the relationship and conversation going, I'm going to have to make some level of accommodation now. I don't think that's a compromise in that sense. I think it's the reality of sharing the gospel, but they're going to know my view. So I don't think I'm compromising truth, but it is if I don't use a name, and I get people who say to me, I don't want to use a name. I said, have you sat down with a trans person and point blank refused to use their name? And I haven't met anybody who's prepared to say that bit yet, because that's the end of the conversation. And at that point, I don't see how I've got a gospel moment with them. So for me, naming is not the hill to die on. but I am really aware of the free speech implications, the ideological implications down the line. So I do want to be careful. It's not just carte blanche. But in the pastoral moment, I think if we don't name people, that's going to be exceedingly difficult to get any further in a gospel conversation.
That is good advice.
Yeah, that is.
A very practical question, Peter, before we take a break here. One of our friends who's watching on Facebook Live right now, Lyle Witcher, has a question. He's a youth pastor. And he says, our camp application has the question, please check the appropriate box for your gender at birth. So it's either male or female. He's wondering if you have any opinion on whether this is offensive or if this would be the proper question you need to ask of those struggling with gender identity.
So the one part of me wants to say sex at birth. You don't have it, you know. So yeah. That's a small, but becoming pedantic in this moment because it's so important. We are, biological sex cannot be changed. And I've been picked up and pushed back on language sometimes. It's so hard. Our own organization was doing a survey and they had male, female, other, or prefer not to say. And I said, guys, take other off. If somebody prefers not to say in a survey, that's different to me. I think I don't see how that question could be offensive just thinking about it. But the real issue is if you don't know somebody, they've got to have a format or they've got to raise if they're going to have a problem being in a different. We need to know their biological sex, and that's what we're going to respect. If they want to identify differently, they've got to tell us, and then we've got to wrestle with what that means for us. So sex is the right question to ask rather than gender, I would say.
And could you make a distinct? I mean, I remember this was a question that you and Ginny Ann talked about on Unbelievable, I know it's kind of basic, but could you just, for some of our listeners who may not know, why is that a big deal, sex instead of gender? What's typically gender is understood differently in this context?
It is. So, I mean, lots of people, gender is very contested phrase even these days, but sex is fundamental, male, female, at birth. It's a biological reality. And then people talk about gender being a social construct. I'm not in favor of that. That's literally something you put on society as these ideas. I think aspects of it are, so I wear pink shirts. I'm very comfortable doing that as a man. Some people
think
pink
Walt.
Is a female
yeah,
color.
I do.
So does Walt. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah. But there's a perception, and 100 years ago, you'd have dressed a baby, a boy in pink, and now that's changed and you dress a boy in blue. And if you were to look at the royal family over here, when they christen a baby, they put this white frilly dress on that's 150 years old because that's what you did for boys back then. Nowadays, we think that looks very female. Those are social ideas around gender that we need to be careful not to hold on to those. Because a boy is interested in cooking, because a boy is interested in art, that does not mean they're a girl or effeminate. We need to do better, I think, at how we raise kids who are like that, because we can stereotype and then say, oh, that's a bit girly. And then the person thinks, well, am I a girl? No, those are perfectly acceptable things for a boy. And similarly with tomboys, we sometimes stereotype and call a girl a tomboy. And she begins to think, well, am I a boy today? That can be really unhelpful. So we need to anchor in on sex. That's a biological reality that cannot be changed. And most within the trans community accept that. But they feel like they're in the wrong body. Now, I'd have lots of questions about what that means. And just to finish that, because I know it's really interesting within the trans community, there's two different views. One says I'm in the wrong body. For that to be the case, you need to have binary, male and female. I'm born male, a male body, but I think I'm female. That requires a binary. The others say I don't believe in sex and gender at all. We're all fluid. We're all everything. And they've got rid of the binary category. So internally, the trans community is inconsistent with each other. And that's actually a real thing worth pointing out gently, humbly in conversation, that it doesn't really make sense internally.
That was, before we take a break, I just want to say that was an interesting piece of the conversation on the Unbelievable podcast when you were having that conversation with Ginny Ann. And, you know, just logically, and I mean, your background as a lawyer came out there. That was fascinating to listen to it. It made me think about it in some new ways. So that was really helpful. By the way, we're going to, and I've mentioned this before, include a link to that particular episode of the Unbelievable podcast. You can hear Peter and Ginny Ann converse there about this issue. We're talking about transgender with Peter Linus. We'll be back after a break. Here at CPYU, we want to help you help parents stay up to date on today's youth culture. One of our most popular resources is our monthly parent page. This four-page, full-color resource offers parents a timely, practical look into current youth culture trends, along with resources to help them parent their children and teens Christianly in today's rapidly changing youth culture. If you're a youth worker who would like to get this monthly resource into the hands of your parents, you can see a sample parent page and learn more by visiting cpyuparentpage.com. Welcome back to Youth Culture Matters. I want to, Peter, ask a question regarding what you've written in Transformed, because I think the theological foundations are so important. You know, theology always informs our practices, our behaviors, and I think we need to be more intentional about our theology. And one of the divisions that I've seen as within the evangelical community is we have more traditional folks, and then we have folks who are labeling themselves and being labeled more progressive, is the way that we use Scripture, the way we understand Scripture, obviously, you know, our sense of, you know, the authority of Scripture, and then also hermeneutics, but the Scriptures that we appeal to. And I've seen, this is just anecdotally, you know, as I've read and I've seen and I've conversed, that there's a camp that by and large will argue when we get to the subject of, you know, same-sex marriage and gender and that sort of thing, argue more from new interpretations of, you know, Old Testament passages, you know, post-fall Old Testament passages, and even some of the New Testament passages, you know, looking at Paul and what did Paul really mean, that sort of thing. And then there are those who go back, and I believe rightly so, to Genesis 1 and 2 in the creation narrative, and looking at this issue within the context of the grand flow of the story of redemption, creation, fall, redemption, restoration. That's what you do in this. Can you just make a comment about that and how important that is, why you choose to look at this issue through that lens, and maybe why it's important for the rest of us to think in those terms?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I think it's really helpful. I think one of the interesting things around transgender is actually you can't just proof text really easily. It actually forces us to think a bit better as Christians. And I think that's no bad thing. You can't just pick out two verses and say, that's it. Yeah. Yes, there's a verse about cross-dressing in Deuteronomy, but that's not going to answer this. So we do go to that larger creation, fall, redemption, restoration arc. And I think that's really helpful. And I think we as evangelicals sometimes have shrunk that story down. And there's a history of doing that in mission where creation and restoration are big issues to get across. So we narrow the story and I say, hey, Walt, you're really bad. I'm a lawyer. I like creating that problem. I barely know you, but I'll say that to you. But it's all right because I've got the solution. Jesus died for you on the cross and he rose again. He's the answer. And we're familiar with that kind of gospel presentation. But it shrunk some stuff down. And what we did was cut out creation and restoration. And that's really important because that's all the stuff about body, creation, marriage, relationships, the foundational stuff in there. And then we have a very narrow, individualistic, soul-orientated gospel. And then these days, it's really hard to say to people, you're really bad. So I don't even start there now. I just say, hey, Jesus loves you. And that's so shallow, so thin a story. Of course, it doesn't work. And that's kind of what we've done with the gospel. So we don't need to shrink it. We need to actually enlarge it and re-inhabit the fuller story so that when we come to an issue like marriage, sexuality, gender, we have a fuller creational story and restorational story that says bodies, physical bodies are important. It's not simply a shell that I inhabit. It's integral to who I am. It's the very means by which I exist in this world. I don't have a simple body that I've been slotted into, and there's not a soul of me separate. And you can hear hints of evangelical fundamentalist idea. There's a soul inside me that goes off to heaven and the body doesn't really matter. That's really dangerous. And it's actually really close to trans ideology. And we need to, you know, speak against that, be a lot clearer. So the body does matter. Sex does matter. He made us male and female. And from that became the man and woman of Genesis 1 and 2, who then the man shall leave his mother and his father and go to be with his wife. The two become one flesh. And I go to conferences and events and people kind of say to me, hey, you never answer any question with anything other than Genesis 1 and 2. And I said, yes, I haven't got much further in the Bible, but it's incredible what it gives us. And then the restoration, but looking ahead too, And we want to say, and these bodies are going to be restored. I don't understand all of what that means, but I know that bodies are important. And that's why something like Paul's teaching around Gnosticism, that somehow there's an inner me, and the Corinthian church were going around saying, hey, food for the stomach for food, meaning it doesn't matter what I eat. And then they were saying, well, hey, it doesn't matter who I sleep with. I can go and sleep with a prostitute because it's only my body. And Paul says, are you nuts? That's the Northern Ireland version of 1 Corinthians. Yeah. Are you guys crazy? Don't you know your bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit? Don't you know your bodies are going to be resurrected, 1 Corinthians 15? Don't you get that bodies matter? So you can't just do whatever you like with your body. It's an integral part of who you are and what God inhabits and dwells. And so that's a conversation I want to have with somebody who's saying, I don't feel I'm in the right body. I'm going to change my body. And I don't think the Bible gives you that option. This is integral to who you are. That body will be restored one day. I'm not saying there's no pain now. I'm not saying there's a quick fix. But sorry, that's maybe a longer answer you wanted. But yes, the full story gives us something to inhabit and dwell. And it's fundamentally different than a very shrunk down gospel that can actually get us into a lot of trouble and maybe suggest why we're having so much issue with some of these questions.
Yeah, that's so good. Before I go back to Duffy, I just want to say, you know, this way of thinking where you look at the biblical narrative from Genesis to Revelation, creation, fall, redemption, restoration, is what I was taught, what I was raised in, what I learned when I was at Geneva College in Western Pennsylvania working with a coalition for Christian outreach. So for me, it's actually been somewhat of a shock and a surprise to me to know that so many in our youth ministry world and so many parents and even so many pastors are totally unfamiliar with this, you know, this redemptive arc in Scripture and how that informs everything, you know, in all of life, and that God's about the process of redeeming all of life. And this is what it means to, we can't understand what it means to flourish as individuals, as the church, as a community, without going back to Genesis 1 and 2. So that's just my input and response there. I thank you for communicating that. Duffy, you had a question.
Yeah, I, again, really enjoyed the interview and unbelievable. And in the give and take, Peter, with your interlocutor, Jenny Ann, there was this kind of dueling scientific research. And I know that as a layperson, I'm not a research scientist, and I know a lot of our listeners are not people who are looking at research journals and stuff. What are some of the criteria by which we can sort of identify the credibility or judge the credibility of a study? As you said, there are activists on both sides who sort of want to manipulate maybe the science to prove their point. What are some criteria that might be helpful in trying to judge whether this is, you know, a fair account of what's really happening out there?
So again, a great question about where the science goes, and I had to dig deep into that. And during the time I was writing this, some of your listeners may have heard this story about a lady called Dr. Lisa Lippman at Brown University. And she put out a paper about rapid onset gender dysphoria. She said, this happens. This is teenage girls, and there's often a contagion effect. So obviously transgender is not contagious, but there's a contagion effect, i.e. people in groups seem to come together around this issue. And that the activists came after her, the paper got pulled down. This was a credible journal, credible research at a credible university. And after a few months, it's gone back up again, almost unaltered, because it had been peer-reviewed. So that'd be one of the questions, is this a peer-reviewed paper, which this was, from a credible university, Brown, this was, from a credible researcher, and it still got pulled down. So this is a highly politicized environment. The leading world expert was a guy called Ken Zucker, who was in Canada, and he was on BBC and on many documentaries. Then somebody went after him, his clinic got shut down, and he's taken a case, and he's just won a lawsuit in the last few months against the Canadian authorities for shutting him down, and he won $500,000, and he was the global authority. In fact, the definition of what a gender dysphoria is, he wrote a number of years ago. So somebody like Ken Zucker is worth following if you're actually, you know, if you've got a child in this area, you're interested. He's much more cautious than some others. So you're looking for peer-reviewed papers, you're looking at the research, and it's highly contested. And in fact, it's very politicized. So we've got to be super careful engaging in that. And yet there are clear trends. You look at the underlying data, The rates of people going to clinics are way up. The age of them going is gone up. And the sex, so it used to be two-thirds, when I said earlier about this switch, it used to be two-thirds boys, male, you know, born male who were going to clinics. Now it's two-thirds females. Now, any scientist, anybody with interest is going to go, wow, that changed in 5 years? Let's look at that. And yet there's almost a block on doing that research. So even the uncontested research raises serious questions, as do the self-harming rates. They're high for everybody before or after an operation. We've got to acknowledge that. This is one of the most marginalized groups in our society. There are not good outcomes, no matter what evidence you look at. So yes, it is tough. I would say a document like ours brings something of a summary of that, unless you're really interested. And then you go and look at the data behind it, peer research, quality journals, if you're into that, and then look at how it's being used in the field afterwards.
Boy, that is okay. Good. I'm just going to mention here quickly that we've talked before about Lisa Lippman's work here in rapid onset gender dysphoria. And it just makes sense to me as someone in youth ministry. Duffy, you get this because you've studied adolescent development. You've taught on it. And when we think about adolescent social development and the need to belong, this provides a place for young people to belong. There's always been these subcultures. And youth workers have to understand this. And this is where, you know, we would go back to things like just the hospitality sense of our youth groups and our churches, and the sense of belonging is so important, especially for those who are most marginalized and, you know, experiencing brokenness in a variety of different ways. This is so good. We're winding down here. I want to end with one last question. I know this has been a great discussion. There's so much more I would like to talk about. But, Peter, could you leave us with just from your work, a very practical recommendation as someone who loves Christ, loves the gospel, and wants to see people, human beings, flourish? What can our friends in youth ministry and our parents, you know, to take away from this? Give us one, you know, good final word here.
So maybe just two very quick things. One is, there's a couple of videos on our site, and it's not about our site, but there's a guy, Tim, whose dad transitioned, and a lady, Jeanette. Sometimes people want the story, because some people love the medical evidence, the stuff we were just talking about, but for many it's those stories. So somebody who's gone through this with a family member, and somebody else who really this was their lived experience. And in Jeanette's case, if she'd been born 20 years later, she would have probably been put through and transitioned. And then when she met Jesus, gosh, the consequences of that would have been so much more severe. So she talks about that. And I think, I mean, the final thing I would say is we've got to lead with compassion. That's got to be our first lens, but not be afraid to raise some of the concerns that everybody has. There is deep confusion out there. And finally, not be afraid to offer a little bit of biblical clarity. The Bible does have something to say about who we are. We are an image-conscious society, and we are struggling with identity politics at this larger level. What's the core message of the gospel? You're sons and daughters of the King. You're loved by Jesus. So we want to bring people back into their core understanding as an image bearer, not somebody who's image conscious and somebody whose identity is in Christ rather than striven, you know, in this world of identity politics, and not make an idol out of this thing to the side, which could be gender or sexuality, and all these things could become idols, both for those who experience it, but sometimes for us on the outside too, saying, well, that's the most important thing right now. Actually, it's not. We have to put everything under submission to Christ and help everybody else to do that. And I do think in this moment, leading people towards Jesus is the key. It's not my job to try and fix, and that's a really blunt term, a trans person. It is Jesus' job to redeem and restore all of us. Our job is to bring them into encounter with Jesus, to lead them as close as we can. And then Jesus and the Holy Spirit has got to do his work in that moment. And I'm so glad, because this is a complex issue. But don't be afraid, you know, get your hands on a resource, but don't let this issue overwhelm you. It's real, but we can respond to it well, I think.
Well, we're going to, Peter, this is great. We're going to include a link to the Evangelical Alliance and to your paper, Transformed. Just as a parting word, any other resources you'd recommend for folks who want to go further into this? Maybe something you read that was especially helpful to you that listeners need to be aware of.
I think if it's very real for you and your family, Mark Yarhouse's resource is really good pastorally. I talk about resource, I'm not saying everything, but it's probably the guy who's done the most work pastorally in this space. And Andrew Walker's really good book on the streams and some of the cultural context that's led us to where we are. So those are two great resources that really help. I'd love to see more groups ministering this space. Certainly in the UK, there's a real lack, and we need to hear more voices. I'm hoping those are coming soon to help parents and to help those in it. It feels like we're on the front edge of this, and we don't have people yet who are all the way through their journey, or at least very few who are able to tell their story. We need more of that. So I'm praying there are more people come through soon to be able to tell their stories, which would really help in terms of support groups and others.
Good. That's great. Chris will put links up to the books from Mark Yarhouse, Andrew Walker's God and the Transgender Debate. Duffy and I love that book. And we'll also include a link to our friends at Harvest USA, who are addressing this in some significant ways and doing just what Peter is recommending here. So, hey,
we should also link to the symposium.
Yes, we'll link to the symposium. Get folks, if you want to join us for that, that's about 4 days of intense conversation, case studies, learning from each other, talking to folks about this and working. It's cohort learning. And it's a wonderful, wonderful time in dealing with something that's pressing and important and that the gospel speaks to so clearly. So, Peter, Duffy, thank you so much for being on. And we're going to visit with you again, Peter, if that's okay. This is great.
Thank you,
Peter.
Okay. Thank you so much. And for everyone listening, thanks for joining us. And we'll catch up with you on the next episode of Youth Culture Matters.
Thanks for joining us for Youth Culture Matters, a podcast from the Center for Parent Youth Understanding. If you'd like to learn more about today's youth culture, visit our website at cpyu.org. And if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, email us at podcast@cpyu.org.